Zionist news. The country has a dark history of human rights violation and violence arising from repeated coups and lack of a powerful central government.
The UNHCR, the UN Refugee Agency, is today calling for the immediate end to all violence in the Central African Republic. Nearly 60,000 people have been forced to seek refuge in neighboring countries in the past month, a twofold rise in just 1 week. Most refugees have fled across the Ubangi River into the Democratic Republic of the Congo, DRC, where the number of arrivals topped 50,000 after 10,000 Central African refugees arrived in a single day on the 13th of January.
Central African Republic's fragile humanitarian situation is worsening, and more than half of the population are reportedly in vital need of humanitarian assistance. Today, the opposition groups reportedly control two-thirds of the country, areas where most of the diamond and gold mines exist. All the wealth and people are struggling. How could that be explained?
The Central African Republic may be the poorest nation in the world. I'm not sure, I haven't looked at every other nation, but in terms of basic parameters of economic development, it's at the lowest end. And this condition is what is driving all the other processes aside from the actual outside instigators. The people in CAR are not provided with a standard of living necessary to maintain themselves and their family and their children. And under these conditions, the violence is very great.
Some of the refugees escaping the conflict head towards neighboring Cameroon, Chad, and the Republic of Congo. The humanitarian assistance by foreign NGOs and aid agencies did not seem enough. The United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees has called for $151.5 million this year to respond to the Central African Republic situation.
I also heard gunshots and I was scared. I told them to wait for me so I could check things out and link up with them afterwards. So they left without looking back. I still as yet do not know where my family is. How are they going to live? If they have run away, how are they going to live?
Central African Republic authorities, meanwhile, are seeking the lifting of the arms embargo to have an upper hand against opposition forces. The constant skirmishes amount to a marked increase in violence, and fighting goes on with no end in sight. So what is the best route the nation can take in the days ahead?
There is no alternative but to have the centralized government in Bangui. The rest of the country is very poor, and there's no ability to run the nation unless the nation is put on a positive course for economic development for its people. And this will require support from the rest of the world. The country is too weak to carry it out itself. And without this long-term commitment, I'm not sure how quickly or easily we will escape the present horrible, horrible conditions that the citizens of the Central African Republic are suffering from right now.
Thanks for your insight, Mr. Lawrence Freeman.
France officially gave independence to CAR in 1960, but has maintained its presence in the chaos following its formal departure. CAR's significance is reiterated with reports of military presence by other countries such as Russia and Rwanda.
The Secretary General remains very concerned over continued destabilization efforts by armed groups in the Central African Republic and calls on all parties to stop violence and engage in meaningful dialogue. He commends the continued engagement of the UN peacekeepers and their efforts to protect civilians and preserve national stability. The Secretary General reiterates the commitment of the UN working closely with national, regional, and international partners to support the cause of peace in the Central African Republic.
The central government only controls one-third of the country, and the rest is under the influence of different armed groups. Basic necessities are becoming scarcer and prices are soaring due to insecurity on the supply routes.
Tensions currently appear to be on the rise in the country, and violence could spiral out of control in the impoverished nation. Mr. Freeman, what do you personally think the rest of the world should do in regard to the situation?
They're very, very poor and very underdeveloped, even though they have natural resources such as water and other capabilities. The government in Bangui which is really the only modern part of the country, its capital, Bangui, has to be supported. And there has to be policies put in place, supported by the rest of the world, especially the leading powers such as China and Russia and the U.S., have to support policies for massive economic development of the nation.
Thanks for that, Mr. Freeman, and we all look forward to peace in the Central African Republic.
Bloodshed in Mozambique.
Shocking news coming out of Mozambique have horrified many in the region. Takfiri terrorists beheaded more than 50 people in the northern Mozambique, frightening the communities. The militants, who reportedly have ties with the Daesh terrorist group, turned a football pitch into an execution ground in the gas-rich Cabo Delgado province.
We hear they are Al-Shabaab or gangs, but to tell you the truth, it is a sad situation that we don't know who is behind these attacks.
Those actions did not target Christians. They were against citizens. They killed both Christians and Muslims, as well as those who practice traditional religions. We do not have religious problems.
There were separate reports of beheadings in other villages, a signature tactic by Daesh to spread fear. The 50 villagers recently beheaded were among those who tried to escape, but were captured by the militants. The atrocity reportedly continued for some time.
We are now joined by Bayomi Azikiwe, editor at Pan-African Newswire, to discuss more details about the situation. Thanks a lot, Mr. Azikiwe. Now, tell us more about the situation in Mozambique and the Muslim communities there.
Now, the Muslim population in Mozambique is very small, less than 10% of the population, but many of them are concentrated in the Cabo Delgado region in the north. So this is an attempt to draw a wedge between that region of the country, with all of its natural resources and potential wealth, to divide them from the rest of the country of Mozambique. So yes, it is definitely a threat to the national security of the country. It's also a threat to the overall development objectives of the Southern African Development Community, which Mozambique is a founding member.
Thanks for that, Mr. Bayomi Azikiwe from the Pan-African Newswire, and stay tuned for more.
There are constant reports of beheadings in Cabo Delgado villages. In an attack on a different village in April, 50 people were beheaded or shot dead. Women are also abducted in such raids, marked by gunshots and setting homes ablaze.
Urgent measures are required today to protect civilians in northern Mozambique, where many people are dying and thousands are forced to flee their homes.
The international community to act, and acting is acting now. We should not wait, because we have 424,000 IDPs, internally displaced people. This is the UN side, but from the government side, they are talking about 570,000.
The assailants have violently seized swaths of territory and stepped up their offensive in recent months. Many of the refugees are trapped in conflict areas, and many resort to hiding in the bush for days. So how did the gas-rich region come to this?
I don't think it's been successful at all. This is an attempt. What is taking place in Cabo Delgado in the north of Mozambique to get a foothold or a beachhead, particularly in areas that have strategic natural resources, energy resources, such as Mozambique. And all along the coast of East Africa and Southern Africa, there have been huge findings of natural gas, of oil, and of course, this has created a scramble on the part of international finance capital to dominate this region even further.
Thanks for your insight, Mr. Abayo Miyazikiwe.
Since the insurgency began in October 2017, more than 2,000 people have reportedly been killed, more than half of whom are civilians. Thousands of people have been displaced, having to seek refuge in nearby towns and cities. With many districts in the north having been cut off, some areas have been denied any humanitarian aid for over 6 months.
The crisis in Cabo Delgado rapidly escalated in 2020, with attacks and fighting forcing tens of thousands of people from their homes every month. Nearly 530,000 people are now internally displaced in Cabo Delgado, Nampula, and Niassa, almost five times the number registered some 9 months ago in March. People fleeing violence in Cabo Delgado have been exposed to severe violations and abuses, and we are especially concerned for the plight of children and women.
That has made the protection of civilians inside and outside the conflict-affected areas a grave task. The Mozambique's government has even called for international help to tackle the insurgency. What options does Mozambique have in seeking help from neighbors or other world countries?
Well, the Southern African Development Community, which has 15 member states, has already offered to provide military forces if the government of Mozambique felt itself threatened or felt it necessary. They're willing to deploy forces to Cabo Delgado in the north of Mozambique. Zimbabwe is also on its own, even though it's also a leading member of SADC, has offered to send troops. Mozambique has had Zimbabwean troops during the 1980s when they were under threat.
Massacre in northern Mozambique has led to international concern about security in the region. Civilians, and especially women and children, are the ones enduring dreadful human rights violations, particularly as COVID-19 rages on in Cabo Delgado province.
The UN High Commissioner has urged all armed actors to take urgent measures to protect civilians, but Mozambique is left on its own to take on the militants. In the meanwhile, the communities will have to deal with killings, maiming, looting, destruction of houses and public and religious facilities, abductions and abuses of girls and women. How does the nation deal with such atrocities, and what role do foreign powers play?
I don't think it's been successful at all. This is an attempt. What is taking place in Cabo Delgado in the north of Mozambique to get a foothold or beachhead, particularly in areas that have strategic natural resources, energy resources, such as Mozambique. And all along the coast of East Africa and Southern Africa, there have been huge findings of natural gas, of oil, and of course, this has created a scramble on the part of international finance capital to dominate this region even further.
The militants are based in the densely forested oil and gas-rich northeast corner of Mozambique. The DAI supporters use operational techniques similar to those from conflicts in Syria, Afghanistan, and Iraq. Mozambique is an important part of the Daesh project to strengthen the Takfiri's presence in southern Africa.
As fighting in the northern province of Cabo Delgado intensifies, Mozambique's president is asking other leaders in southern Africa for help.
The problem of Mozambique, the problem of Zimbabwe, problem of Zambia, of Namibia, of Botswana, everywhere. And this is why. But the target reachable, we believe that we together are going to work hard to make sure that our region is peaceful.
The expansion of the insurgency, which began along the coastal area of Cabo Delgado, has now reached into the heartland of the Makonde tribe. According to Mozambique's officials, the militants are being equipped and trained by foreign affiliates of the ISIS or Daesh terrorist group. Last year, Daesh formally adopted the Mozambique wing of its Central African province known as ISCAP. Mr. Azikiwe, how do you evaluate the spread of ISIS takfiris in the region?
There's an attempt for these groups to get a foothold on the continent. They have not been able to effectively penetrate the Southern Africa region due to the, a lot of it has to do with the coherency of the political and economic programs in the region. But they are going to continue to try in order to disrupt the developmental process in Southern Africa and Africa as a whole.
Thanks for that insight, Mr. Azikiwe.
International oil firms such as French company Total have so far been unaffected by the conflict, but the expansion of the insurgency has also frightened the West. It is claimed that it is ready to help the government tackle insurgency with cooperation from South Africa and Tanzania.
Many people have been forced to move multiple times, and the situation of those affected by the conflict is worsening rapidly. More than 2,000 people have been killed since the conflict started in 2017. In the violence, houses have been looted and burned, families separated, and health centers and schools seriously damaged. Access to agricultural land has been blocked and other economic activities curtailed. There's a serious indication that this crisis could spread beyond the country's borders if it goes unstopped.
The Mozambican military, which relies on private military contractors from Zimbabwe and South Africa, has reportedly shown a weak performance in its confrontation with the militants or terrorists. The Mozambique insurgency is one of the many others underway in Nigeria, Mali, Niger, and Burkina Faso. The militants are reportedly well organized and have good logistics. I'm Obara Kenya. Please share your views with us. Until next time, when you come back for another episode of Africa Today, goodbye and take care.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
Europe is facing an accelerating health, economic and political crisis amid high coronavirus infection rates, hospitalizations and deaths in many countries. The European economy remains largely in lockdown. More infectious virus variants are spreading. Mexico surpassed India in coronavirus-related deaths with about 1,506 new fatalities on Thursday, 28th of January. We're prepared for a report written by staff writers of the Reuters news agency under the heading Europe's Crisis Accelerates, Mexico's Virus Toll Now World's Third. Stay with us for more of the Reuters news agency report. Mexico overtakes India with the third highest number of coronavirus fatalities after the United States and Brazil. In Europe, countries consider imposing new restrictions as a new variant of COVID-19 that initially emerged in Britain continues to rise across the European continent. Mexico surpassed India in coronavirus-related deaths with about 1,506 new fatalities on Thursday, 28th of January 2021. The additional deaths pushed the total number of fatalities in Mexico to 155,145. Mexico's health ministry also reported 18,670 new confirmed cases of COVID-19, bringing the total number to 1,825,519 across the North American country. In Mexico City, hospitals are nearing capacity, and a shortage of oxygen tanks has complicated the treatment of COVID-19 patients. According to a Reuters tally, India, a country with a population more than 10 times that of Mexico, has reported a total death toll of about 154,000. According to Deputy Health Minister Hugo López-Gatell, Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador, who said he had tested positive for COVID-19 himself recently, is now improving. The president has so far resisted imposing mandatory lockdowns to curb the spread of COVID-19. Europe is facing an accelerating health, economic and political crisis. Amid high infection rates, hospitalizations and deaths in many countries, the European economy remains largely in lockdown. More infectious virus variants are spreading across the European continent. The French health minister, Olivier Véran, said recently the government's current restrictive measures in France are becoming ineffective because the number of cases of new variant of COVID-19 keeps steadily rising. Olivier Véran said the new variant constituted 3.2% of total positive cases at the beginning of January, but that figure has increased to about 1 in 10 of all cases. Olivier Véran said from 500 cases then, we are today at more than 2,000 cases daily, adding that new variants of the virus are the worrying parameter as they are more contagious. Olivier Véran warned about the emergence of a pandemic within the pandemic as the new variant of COVID-19 is circulating more widely and is spreading faster every week. The French health minister added the effectiveness of the curfew is now waning. According to the latest figures, the number of new COVID-19 cases reached a record high of about 27,000 by the end of Thursday evening, 28th of January. An additional 350 deaths were also reported. The country, with a total number of 3,166,145 infection cases and 74,601 fatalities, has been under almost a year-long lockdown to combat the pandemic. The French government spokesman, Gabriel Attal, said the French government is considering scenarios ranging from maintaining the current framework to a very tight containment policy. According to the most recent opinion polls, this has raised the possibility of a third lockdown in France in less than 12 months. The country went into lockdown twice last year, the first between March and May, and the second between October and December. French government is now cautious that a third lockdown could spark angry protests similar to the protests which took place in the Netherlands recently. Protests hit the Netherlands against coronavirus lockdown measures, the first ever curfew since the Second World War, with the Dutch police using tear gas and water cannon to disperse angry protesters. Police have arrested hundreds of people during days of unrest over the past 2 weeks in cities across the Netherlands, where protesters set fire and violently clashed with members of the security forces. Social media users in France have started calling for civil disobedience using the hashtag Je ne me reconnaîtrai pas, I will not go back into lockdown, on Twitter. The United Kingdom has also seen several anti-lockdown protests as millions of people have long been living under restrictive measures. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson warned lately that tough measures may continue into the spring and even beyond into the summer. Some 24 million people, representing 43% of Britain's population, are currently living under lockdown in the United Kingdom. Under the restrictions, non-essential shops, hairdressers and gymnasiums remain closed. The order also includes a warning to stay at home, placing a limit on household mixing to 2 people outdoors. According to the Johns Hopkins University, the pandemic has so far infected a total number of 3,760,000 people and killed over 103,000 others across the United Kingdom. According to the Foreign Policy magazine, Europe finds itself in an economic and political explosive situation. The Foreign Policy magazine said on Friday, 29th of January, that the European continent will not be able to reopen its economy expeditiously, at least not without a ruinous death toll. It added, there will also not be any quick fixes in the coming weeks, as complex vaccine manufacturing capacity cannot be magically conjured up overnight. Amid the crisis, the World Health Organization, WHO, launched an investigation into the origins of the COVID-19 pandemic in the Chinese city of Wuhan on Friday, 29th of January, 2021. The World Health Organization sent a team of investigators to Wuhan, China, where the first ever coronavirus infection was reported. The team of experts met with a group of Chinese scientists in the central Chinese city of Wuhan ahead of a series of field visits to hospitals, to laboratories, and the now closed Huanan market, which was said to have been the link between the first cases of the coronavirus infection. The World Health Organization said in a tweet, all hypotheses are on the table as the team follows the science in their work to understand the origin of the COVID-19 virus. It urged China to provide the team of investigators with the support, access and data that they need. Earlier this month, the World Health Organization technical lead on the disease, Maria Van Kerkhove, said the world may never find patient zero in its search for the origins of the coronavirus. The emergence of the coronavirus in Wuhan, China, has prompted the US and some other allies to claim that the virus had originated in the laboratory in the Chinese city of Wuhan and blamed China for the spread of the disease. White House spokesperson Jen Psaki said recently that it was imperative we get to the bottom of how the coronavirus appeared and spread worldwide. White House spokesman Jen Psaki urged a robust and clear investigation into the origins of the coronavirus pandemic, alleging that there might have been some misinformation from some sources in China.
The debate.
The European Union and British-based pharmaceutical company AstraZeneca have become embroiled in a fierce row over the supply of coronavirus vaccines. The European Commission says that the Anglo-Swedish firm is not honoring its contract to provide a specific number of shots. AstraZeneca has said it will not be able to deliver as many vaccines to the EU as initially hoped because of a production glitch, a claim disputed by the EU. The company announced the initial deliveries would be approximately 31 million doses, far less than the anticipated 80 million. To make things even more complicated, the EU confirmed new bans on certain vaccine exports from the continent to cover the supply shortages. Blocking the shipment of vaccines made within Europe will most likely cause a broader disruption of vaccine supplies, not just for the UK, but for numerous countries around the world.
The first coronavirus case was reported some 1 year ago in Europe. No one at a time would have imagined the massive scale of death and devastation it would wreak on the continent and around the globe. Nearly 30 million cases and 700,000 deaths have been registered in Europe alone since the beginning of the coronavirus outbreak. The actual numbers, however, are set to be much higher given the fact that many infection cases have gone unnoticed. Just days ago, the UK became the first European country to crest a grim milestone of 100,000 deaths. This is while economic powerhouse Germany continues to report daily deaths of around 1,000. Less populated countries have not been immune either. Portugal, with a population of 10 million, currently has the world's highest per capita 7-day averages of both new cases and deaths. COVID-19 and problems surrounding the disease have been compounded by the spread of more infectious and deadlier strains of the virus. The continent has been struggling to contain the pandemic despite imposing lockdowns and strict curbs, including border closures. The World Health Organization says it's too early to ease the restrictions. The UN Health Agency's European branch says transmission rates across Europe are still very high, impacting health systems and straining services. However, the lockdowns in several cases met with opposition and dissatisfaction among the public, sparking protests across the continent. Ironically, even the development of vaccines has failed to alleviate concerns. In fact, frustration is growing in the European Union after a second coronavirus vaccine manufacturer warned of supply issues to the bloc. After a cut in deliveries of the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine slowed some nations' inoculation programs, AstraZeneca dealt a fresh blow by saying the number of initial doses available would be lower than expected due to production problems. The EU Health Commissioner has expressed, quote, deep dissatisfaction as millions of lives have been put at risk.
Points in all of this all along was the issue of transparency, and we had EU lawmakers and so on accusing the European Commission of showing a lack of transparency in terms of its dealings with the pharmaceutical companies. And now we have a situation where the European Commission is accusing the pharmaceutical companies of showing a lack of transparency.
COVID-19 has relentlessly battered Europe for nearly a year. Lives have been lost and livelihoods have been destroyed. But the pandemic has also had other impacts, exposing Europe's frailties, not only in its poor preparations and medical responses, but in its leadership dysfunctionality and disunity.
Joining us on this edition of The Debate, we have author and broadcaster Jonathan Fryer. Joining us from London also, we have senior analyst at Foreign Policy and Focus, Mr. Ian Williams, who is joining us from New York. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Fryer in London. AstraZeneca, they're blaming a production fault for this delay. What do you think is really going on in this supply row?
Well, I think we should believe what AstraZeneca is saying, is that unfortunately they've not been able to produce as much of the vaccine as many countries wanted. We should note that the European Union only approved the AstraZeneca vaccine today, whereas Britain did that some weeks ago. And of course, Britain got in much earlier with its orders than the European Union, so received quite a good amount of vaccines from AstraZeneca and also of the
Pfizer-BioNTech, which is mainly made in Belgium, which is why Britain has managed to vaccinate, at least with the first dose, about 8 million people already, which is way ahead of all the other EU 27 member states. So there's quite a lot of frustration on the European continent that actually they've been caught napping on this, that they are way behind what they would have hoped, and certainly way behind the British, although of course Britain does have the worst cases, the number of deaths of any country in Europe.
Mr. Williams, in New York, what do you think about the issue? Our guest in London believes that this is probably just a glitch. There are contrary beliefs to that as well. Is the British-based AstraZeneca misleading the European Union, in your opinion?
Well, it's not misleading. It might have been rosily optimistic in the contracts it signed. And there are big dilemmas here. I mean, Britain is no longer in the European Union. But even if it were, the British government would have a hard time saying, oh, we're making these vaccines here, but the company has a contract with the European Union. So they've got to go to the European Union and drive past dying people in Britain. It's a political dilemma that's not an easily reconcilable one. And we saw that with Donald Trump when he tried to sequestrate supplies of vaccines made by in Europe and other places for America. You know, the politicians will want to look after their own voters first. Not necessarily their own people, but their own voters, definitely. You know, in many ways, I think it's not often I boost pharmaceutical companies, but it is worth realizing that this production of a vaccine within a year of the serious onset of the epidemic is pretty much a landmark in modern medicine. Most vaccines take years, decades to produce. The fact that within a year they've got three or four workable vaccines going, I had my first shot here in New York a week ago, and I'm hoping to have the other one next week. But it's a remarkable achievement in its way. Where it falls down is in the delivery, and you know, there you have to compare Europe, for example, which actually has a sort of a more rational health system, even the separate countries do, compared with the US, where it tends to be chaotic, and there's apart from, you know, it depends on the states, and some states have a rational distribution method, and others you've seen, you know, occasions where the vaccines go missing or go to the wrong people, or they can't get to the people who really need them, because there's no machinery for mass inoculation. Even in Britain, it's not the same machinery there was a few years ago when the National Health Service had massive inoculation campaigns for TB and other ailments. So that's somewhat fallen by. But, you know, we have to give credit where it's due to those companies that have produced the vaccine and the universities that are involved as well, of course, because there's a lot of government money involved in here. Well, no, the companies will take the credit if it wins, but the fact that they were promised their investment back by lots of governments will tend to get overlooked.
Sure.
And this is very much a public-private partnership.
Mr. Fryer, let's address the elephant in the room that was also mentioned by Mr. Williams in New York. Is Brexit playing a role in all of this?
I don't think Brexit is directly playing a role, but indirectly it is. There is unfortunately a very sour relationship between the EU 27 and Britain at the moment, not because of Brexit, but because of what has happened since Brexit, in particular the way that basically the British government has been accusing the EU of not handling the post-Brexit situation properly, and in particular calling in what they see as vaccine nationalism or COVID nationalism, which is where individual European countries are at each other's throats because of the COVID situation. And in particular, there is the problem about Northern Ireland, because Northern Ireland, which is a province of the United Kingdom, nonetheless has remained within the single market of the European Union in order to be able to trade freely with the Republic of Ireland, the most of the island of Ireland. But there is a huge row today where the First Minister of the Northern Ireland administration, who was very much pro-Brexit, has really said that the EU is acting like a bully by threatening to cut off supplies of COVID vaccines to Northern Ireland, whereas according to the EU plans for the single market, it ought not to do that. But I think we also have to bear in mind an important fact, that health matters are what's called national competence. In other words, this is the responsibility of national governments, not of the EU as such. And this is really the first time that the European Union has tried, despite that fact, to introduce a Europe-wide vaccine policy to get vaccines to everyone. But it hasn't properly worked, and individual states, we heard earlier how Hungary has put in orders for China and Russia, and other countries have put their orders wherever they feel vaccines will come. But it is rather a chaotic mess at the moment, all against the backdrop of a real crisis in the health situation, an understandable worry about people right across Europe about when and if they will actually get their vaccine.
Ian Williams, so let's basically look at it this from this vantage point. If there's a market there right now and the demand is there and the European countries, as you also mentioned, have invested billions in the vaccine development, despite the strong demand, why is there a lack of doses? Do you think that vaccines produced within the EU might be going to higher bidders outside of the bloc?
Well, they might well do under normal, but I don't think so. I think what we're looking at is, there are contracts to be fulfilled. The European Union has altruistically entered into agreements with other countries across the world to supply vaccines under the COVAX agreement. There are commitments here, and it's, some of them are quite altruistic. But also, it's in the nature of the way things are now that you have highly centralized production, and all it takes is a glitch in one factory, one line to go, and vaccine production is out for the whole continent. So the centralization of production might lead to greater efficiency, might lead to efficiencies of scale on one side, but it also diminishes the resilience of the whole production process. So one glitch in one production line can stop the whole continental supply, whereas at one time it would have been just a regional problem.
Mr. Farr, what about the overall policies of European countries in dealing with the COVID-19 outbreak? Despite the restrictions and the lockdowns, cases are still on the rise. Unfortunately, fatalities are still increasing. The economy has suffered immensely. What went wrong in the equation? The lockdowns, as we know, saw a lot of protests across Europe. The recent ones in Netherlands also turned violent.
That's true. Of course, I think we need to recognize that the anti-lockdown groups, protesters, are a minority and, frankly, acting against the interests of majority of the people who understand perfectly well why there have to be lockdowns, why there have to be restrictions of various kinds. But Europe has really suffered unfairly in many ways from the fact that there is freedom of movement, so not in the normal times people can circulate around Europe perfectly freely, and indeed Europeans travel all over the world. Earlier there was mention made of Portugal and the particularly sad cases that we're seeing now in Portugal, and that's largely because it's a bridge really to Brazil and other parts of South America, and the new variant, the Brazilian variant, has come in to Europe via Portugal and is now seen in several member states of the European Union and as well as here in Britain. So although border restrictions are being brought indeed Britain has brought in travel restrictions against quite a number of countries, including the UAE is the latest being added to the list, that in a sense is shutting the stable door after the horse has bolted, because the infections have spread so fast and so far in Europe because basically Europeans move around a great deal and they mix with people from all over the world.
Mr. Williams, I saw you nodding there. Would you like to add anything to that?
Well, I was just thinking back. I was looking at the list of things today, and it was about a year ago that the British government, just being, you know, echoing Trump, was being somewhat dismissive of it, and they allowed 3,000 football fans to fly from Spain to Liverpool, when Spain, Madrid was at the height of an epidemic. I mean, there's been a complete lack of common sense precautions by the British government on many ways, and it's one of the things that's led to the scepticism that we're just talking about. I mean, you can understand people being skeptical when they're told, first of all, the masks are necessary, then they're not necessary, and then you begin to suspect that the real reason they want people not to wear masks is because they're short of them, and they want to reserve them for particular occupations like the hospitals. So, you know, there's been a lack of transparency by governments, not just in Europe, but all over the world. It's, you know, in some parts of the world, they've locked up journalists for reporting about it. Egypt was deporting a Guardian journalist for reporting accurately on the casualties. So you can understand that there's a lot of skepticism. I mean, it's almost unpardonable, the cranks, the anti-vaxxers and the anti-lockdowners who are gathering in large infectious numbers on the streets of cities across Europe to protest measures taken to ensure their health. But you can see why they would be skeptical. Governments have bred that skepticism. Right across the world, governments have given people very good reason to doubt them. And there's also that ever-present suspicion that no government will leave a crisis like this untended to, in terms of restricting people's liberties, keeping an eye on people, scrutinizing them. So, you know, travel restrictions, wow, great. It's not even national borders. Remember, people are being arrested for driving from one city to another inside Britain and inside Europe. People are being arrested for driving on the hills. And the point is, of course, this is, of its necessity, is going to be capricious. The police will be arresting people who they don't like. And we know who the police tend not to like in societies like Britain and America. They tend not to like minorities, and they suspect them of spreading disease more than anyone else. So, you know, the statistics come out. These strain society in a big way. It's not just the European Union where the fracture lines are showing. It's inside countries as well.
Sure.
And governments have encouraged this. Governments have done it because their behavior has led to understandable suspicion on the part of the public.
Jonathan Fryer, touching on a point that was just mentioned by our guest in New York, fraction lines are just beginning to emerge. Speaking of Hungary has become the first EU member to approve the Chinese-made Sinopharm vaccine. It means that Hungary continues to diverge from the EU, as last week Budapest approved Russia's Sputnik V vaccine. So essentially, this shortfall is pushing the bloc to a crisis point where, despite all the money invested in European countries, now EU countries are turning elsewhere to get what they need.
Yes, of course, that is true. And we have to bear in mind the fact that the EU paid up front hundreds of millions of euros in order to get doses of the vaccines, including the Oxford-AstraZeneca vaccine, which is why there is the current row at the moment. They've said, we paid for it, we've signed a contract, where is the vaccine? It should be here by now, and it isn't. As you was mentioned in your introduction, basically there's a shortfall of about 50 million doses out of 80 million, which is a serious shortfall. But I'd like to echo Ian's comments about the pathetic messaging, really confusing messaging, that's come out from several governments, not least the British government, about this. And this is largely because we have a prime minister here, Boris Johnson, who is a libertarian, who believes that people should be asked to do things, not told to do things, and that it should be as free as possible to do what they like. And whereas in principle that's all very well, in a pandemic situation, it's pretty catastrophic. And I think this is why the British people have been confused by this messaging. The ridiculous promise that the Prime Minister made that we'd be able to have Christmas with our loved ones in December turned out to be a dreadful mistake and has led to the recent rise in cases here. So it is a complicated situation, but inevitably member states of the European Union, the 27 member states, are sovereign states. They're quite entitled to make their own arrangements if they want to get other vaccines in, as Hungary is doing from China and Russia. But the European Union, having paid for vaccines from AstraZeneca and others, would like to see those arrive as soon as possible. Though, as I mentioned earlier, I think there really is a genuine problem in actual production at the moment.
Ian Williams, here's a different perspective. We have wealthy countries arguing over the vaccine. The poorer countries are not even getting a glimpse of what they need. So what's the situation going to be like for the poor and lower income countries of the world? We know this is a global pandemic, and if it's to end, it has to end globally.
Well, I have to give some credit to the European Union there. They have made serious efforts with the COVAX program to attempt to make sure that supplies are available for other countries. But naturally, they have taxpayers. The taxpayers have put this money up, their taxpayers, and they want first dibs in it. The fact that the European Union is allowing vaccines to go to other countries, even while people at home are clamoring for them, is, you know, that's the way it should be. That's the way it should be. We should encourage that. But there is a sense of responsibility here, and I just want to pick up where Jonathan left. In an older golden days of British responsibility and politics, any other Prime Minister would have handed in his resignation after presiding over a series of decisions that cost tens of thousands of his constituents' lives. And the fact that Johnson is still there, still unabashed, and still unresigned, I think, shows that we are dealing with a completely different degree of political responsibility now.
All right, we're going to have to leave it there.